Hi, this is Leonard Peikoff here to apply Ayn Rand's philosophy of objectivism to your real-life questions. My responses cover subjects of general interest, such as human relationships, career, and morality, but not current politics. My answers are posted every week on Mondays, and you can listen to full episodes on iTunes or listen to single questions or full episodes on my website. Several years of podcasts are now easily searchable by topic or keywords. If you have a philosophical question to ask me, simply go to www.peikoff.com, and that's spelled P as in Peter, E-I-K-O-F-F, like the word off, peikoff.com. And of course, feel free to follow me on Facebook and Twitter. Does the offspring of a diabetic parent have a reasonable beef with his parent if he contacts diabetes in his life? My brother got juvenile diabetes when he was 17. His son was diagnosed with it at age 20 and blames his father. Should my brother have questioned having children, knowing diabetes is hereditary and could be passed to his children? I'd say within limits, the choice on this kind of issue is entirely the parents, and they're not wrong going either way. This is an issue that you do not know. You have a statistic, you have a genetic guess, but you don't know. In that case, you don't have knowledge of what the result will be. So long as that's the case, you have to decide what the chances are realistically. And then also enters into it, what is the nature of the ailment if your child gets it? Now, if you are passing on brain retardation, you know, some kind of heart which you have to stay in bed all your life, then I think it's irrational to have a child. But if a child, even with a disease, is able to function well, I don't see that is wrong. It's a function of to what extent can he be and live a normal human life, and to what extent is he impaired? If he needs to have a needle every day, that's one thing. If he needs to be in a mental home, that's another thing. So I don't fault, as much as I understand diabetes, which is not much, I don't see that is a disqualifying disease. But I might be wrong, but that's my understanding. Now, as to the child, I think it's an outrage if he blames his father, he holds a grudge against his father. That is really fantastic. That amounts to saying, I am mad at you for having me exist. You should never have brought me into existence. I would have been much better off if I was a zero. And that is fantastic. You can blame people for various things, but not for the fact that you exist. Plus, if you don't like it, you've got the easy way out. You just go on a 405 in Southern California, just walk across five lanes, and that's it. You don't have diabetes, you don't have existence, they can't even find the shreds of your body. So you don't have to blame your father if you really wish you hadn't existed. You could end the whole thing in a minute. I'm not recommending that, but he didn't put you in his capable trap. I literally can't imagine being mad at anybody because they brought me into existence. Even if I was miserable, say thanks, but it didn't work out, and leave. I don't believe in God, but I don't totally discount that an entity beyond our comprehension or understanding might exist. For instance, like the way nuclear fusion would have been incomprehensible to a caveman. Can't there be something like that to us? You got to distinguish unknown and beyond our understanding. Beyond our understanding would mean we can't connect it to anything we know. It's non-rational. It can't be processed by our mental mechanism. It's non-logical. Obviously, then we can't understand. We can understand only the motives of the people who say those things. But something which you define as intrinsically irrational can't be understood because such a phenomenon can't actually exist. Now, the caveman certainly can't comprehend nuclear fusion, but for that very reason, it never comes up in his life. He doesn't go around thinking, well, maybe there is nuclear fusion, but I can't understand it yet. He can't even conceive of it. At the point when you can conceive of it, and that means find a basis in reality that make the issue a possibility, at that point, you start understanding it. Until that point, it's entirely arbitrary. You've got to go strictly by evidence. You can never say something is possible except if you tie that possibility to reality. Now, here I refer you to Opar. There's many things that are unknown, but when you talk about something analogous to a God, you're not talking about the unknown, you're talking about the mystical, and that is out by its nature. You read my chapter on that in Opar. And this gentleman identifies himself under name as Embarrassing Question. What do you think of an older man masturbating to pictures of much younger but legal women? So it's not statutory, it's not fantasy statutory. Is it psychologically destructive to practice getting aroused to people who, due to a large age difference, would never be available to oneself? I don't see that that is necessarily destructive. If the woman that you're projecting is in some way you see her as a projection of your values, but simply a younger version. If you met someone with those values that you thought was available, that's what you would want. I don't see any harm. But then the question I would ask, now I assume you're pretty advanced age here. At your age, do you want an older value soulmate woman if you could find one? Now, if you say no, you've given that realm up for whatever reason, you're disappointed you've had it, then I don't think you can do anything wrong in the realm of masturbation. You're getting such sexual pleasure as you can get, and you've cut the rest off. But if you do still have the idea that someday, somewhere, you would want to find such a person, then I think your practice is harmful because it diverts you from looking for others. It makes it less of a priority because you're getting something at home. It strengthens the meaningfulness of the fantasy to you, what a role it plays in your life. And, fantasy is a lot easier than reality because you don't have to go to Starbucks and have coffee and try and figure out is she lying, or et cetera. You just make it up and whatever you want happen. So I would say if you want something from reality, don't live in fantasy. And now and then as a projection, that's okay. If you reach the stage or the age where that's out and something turns you on, and let's say hopefully something other than necrophilia or bestiality or that type of thing. When you say a young girl over the age of consent, I can't criticize that. Here's one. It's vanity on my part to answer, but I'll be very brief. You have really great hair for a 78-year-old. I'm going to be 79 in a couple of weeks. Is that genetic, or did you have anything done to enhance it? The hair is entirely natural. No enhancement. But the color for a long time was enhanced. All the gray was colored out. But no more. Once I reached this age, I figured for the last part of my life, I should look the way I am. And I'm not on TV anymore, so it doesn't matter. Well, here's a question I summarized in my own words because it was too long. Why do you differentiate D2 from M2? Or the example he gives is Obama from Marx. Because they have many destructive similarities. They're both against the rich, against Wall Street, against capitalism, against individualism, etc. So is there really such a big difference? I say, well, yes, they're very similar. And those two are both, of all the five possibilities I mentioned, those two are far and away the most destructive. But there is a difference in their goal and their method. The Obama type is erratic, short range, unprincipled, and has no ideology, which they themselves insist on. They're not trying to remake life or to shun the idea of creating a utopia. They think that's ridiculous. We want to be realistic. They do have a guiding goal, but the guiding goal is annihilate. You have to read the book to see why I say that. In the process, they annihilate a lot of the things that the socialists are after. So they can form an alliance. But a true socialist, a true M2, a Marxist or Hitler type, is long range. They have a whole system, a whole ideology, a view of the world, of the laws of the world, of the future that man is to aim at. They advocate we're going to achieve the perfect society through these stages, and therefore all of this in their mind is calculated. And the whole thing is made possible only by an ideology. Without an ideology, you just lurch. Now, the Obama type just lurches from, I was going to say murder, but I have to do it metaphorically, from one destruction to another, that does not give them a great popular appeal. I believe myself that the nihilist type, which is now in power, will not be the ultimate winners in the United States, because it's becoming clearer and clearer to people that the have-nots are not getting better and the haves are getting worse. And pretty soon, they'll start to believe what they see, and there will be various crises and catastrophes. And at that point, an M2, real totalitarian, will arise and offer a whole system of how to get out of here and rise, be saved, etc., and that will take over. There can be no mass base to destruction as an end in itself, but there certainly can be to, you know, self-sacrifice for a noble ideal. All of history proves that. You have to read my book to get that point. Why was the concept of man worship not covered in your book, Opar? Isn't it central to objectivism? I left it out because it is not a purely philosophical concept. It certainly does involve a view of man, of human efficacy, of values, of the benevolent universe, but of the nature of man as a rational being. But man worship is used primarily by Ayn Rand in a sexual or romantic context. It pertains to, given the nature of male and the nature of female and all the rest of the value structure of a proper philosophy, what should be the attitude of one to the other? That is not something that philosophy as such can answer. You'd have to know what is the relevant psychological implications of the biological differences, of the anatomical differences. That can be known, but it certainly doesn't come under philosophy. That's why I left it out. If you want to know more about Ayn Rand's philosophy, I invite you to ask me a question. I can't answer them all, but I do read them all. Just write to leonard@peikoff.com. And if you haven't already done so, start by reading Ayn Rand's two most famous novels, The Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged. Thanks for listening.